Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Centre for Brexit Studies podcast with me, Jessica Guy, Centre Director Professor Alex de Ruyter, and today's special guest, visiting professor with the Centre, former leader of Birmingham City Council and current Labour councillor for Quinton Ward, John Clancy. Hello both and welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello, Jess.
I'll now hand over to Professor de Ruyter to conduct today's episode.
Thanks, Jess. Well, hello, John.
Hi.
John, we're here today to talk about how pension liabilities might become a big issue in the UK's Brexit negotiations. On this note, I see that the EU Commission has just quietly published its 2017 accounts. About a week last Friday, roughly, they slipped out. Did you spot that? I'm guessing not many of us might have.
Well, indeed I did. Not many people did, but I did. And I've spent the last week or so here at the Centre for Brexit Studies poring over them. And if you look closely at the very boring bits, something of a bomblet is contained. And that is, the Brexit bill has just soared upwards. And I think the UK needs now to ask some tough questions of both the EU Commission about their figures, and questions which, to be frank, the Treasury and our negotiators should have been asking a long time ago, and obviously of our negotiators.
So what particular questions would those be?
Well, the liabilities included in the accounts for the EU's Civil Service Pension Fund have just hit €73 billion. Now, the problem is that the UK, on leaving next March, has to commit to pay its share of that huge figure in one way or the other. And it is actually one of the biggest items on the Brexit bill. Now, you'd have thought, therefore, that everyone would have been clear what it was, that pension fund liability. And we're meant to be sorting this by, I think, the end of October this year.
Well, yes. I mean, as an aside, I suppose I'd suggest that an October deadline for negotiating the withdrawal agreement really doesn't look feasible now. Mm. Of course, privately, EU officials concede that December seems more likely. However, debate over whether December gives sufficient time for ratification of a withdrawal agreement is almost an irrelevance at this point. The chances of actually meeting an October deadline are now rapidly diminishing towards zero, you know, assuming, of course, that the EU accept Mrs. May's latest proposals, which we don't think they will.
Yep.
And December even appears optimistic. I guess, if nothing else, John, that should give some more time for someone in Whitehall to get to grips with the pensions issue.
Yeah, I take that very point. But to reiterate, in all of the calculations by all of the apparent numbers experts, very few have gone on to ask serious basic questions about this huge figure. Now, especially as there is actually no pension fund in existence. So like our doctors and nurses in the NHS, our teachers, the UK Army, judges, civil servants, there is actually a pretend fund for accounting purposes. But in reality, it just pays out monthly pensions and takes in monthly contributions, and they mostly balance at the year end. And if there's a shortfall, the Treasury plugs the gap, and if there's a surplus, there usually is, the Treasury happily gobbles it up.
So, John, are you implying then that this is the same construct with the EU, that there's no actual fund, so to speak? I'd be intrigued to probe you further, if you'll pardon that expression, mm-hmm. as to how you define a pretend fund. Is this just an annual accounting exercise, so to speak?
That's exactly what it is. Every year there is an accounting exercise and figures go in that. Now, in the past, it's not been that important, but obviously in the current circumstances of calculating this bill, it's suddenly very important. And that those accounts say, those that came out a week last Friday or so, says there's a big bill now of €73 billion. We sort of ignored it in the past, but now it's different. So that figure, it's all very complicated, but that's how much the EU has already committed to pay to today's EU civil servants, and expects to have to pay those same civil servants over the next few decades when they come to retirement or if they are actually retired. And they come up with that figure every year. Now, the problem is that just 5 years ago, the figure was only, if you can use that word, was only €42 billion. So the first obvious question you'll be asking, and our negotiators should have asked, is what on earth has happened to almost double the EU pension fund bill in 5 years?
Indeed, John, this is after all rather unfortunate timing for the UK. particularly given the rather parlous current state of Brexit negotiations, as we touched on earlier.
Well, quite so. But why, I think another question which is immediately prompted is why has there been so much of an increase in just this last 2 years? It's gone up by €10 billion since 2015 and over €6 billion since the last accounts. Surely this isn't the EU Commission or its negotiators pulling a fast one at the last. I don't know. So what actually happened this year to end up with such a shock increase in liabilities at year end? Now, the EU's also going to have another go on the 31st of December this year at naming the figure. Big question. Do we expect the December 31st 2018 figure to be substantially higher again?
That's a very challenging point, John, about just trying to establish what their methodology is here. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. this is indeed the case, then we should start to seriously question the entire basis for the EU's figures.
Definitely. And in my judgment is that there is actually an explanation, if not an excuse, for these quickly inflating figures. And we need, I think, quickly to halt the train before it hurtles towards us at the last minute. The explanation is, I believe, that the EU has literally got its figures wrong. It has failed to reflect in its calculations, in those accounts, the actual market conditions, or rather lack of them, which led to that €73 billion calculation. In fact, it could be said it's created a false market conditions to come up with the figure.
Well, false market conditions, John, is quite a contentious, if not, shall we say, controversial statement. Could you please explain this further for our listeners?
Well, again, I think the relationship is complicated. It's a bit like Facebook status. It's complicated. But I think it is the case that they are at least aware that the market conditions which they have used to calculate are not real. Because when the EU calculates its accounts, it basically uses bond figures prevailing at the time in the market to set what's called the discount rate. Now, this interest rate, the discount rate, is the biggest factor when it calculates its final pension fund liabilities. Because it has to value future liabilities and future cash flows at today's prices to come up with a liability. And they do that by discounting a certain amount off that big figure that the EU has to pay in the end, but then it calculates backwards to today or to the day that they do those accounts. Now, over history, discount rates have settled at around about 7% for funded pension funds. Now, the problem is, perhaps counterintuitively, the lower the discount rate, the higher the liabilities become, and vice versa. You can think of future liabilities as some massive iceberg, and then the discount rate sets how many ice cubes you chip away, or the rates you chip them away from the iceberg over time back to today, which gives you a smaller but prudent iceberg for accounting purposes. Now, on one level, if you think about it, if you chip away 7,000 ice cubes a minute rather than 300 ice cubes a minute, then you're 7,000 cube cup iceberg gets a lot smaller over time than the other. Now, research tells us also that when you go below 3% on a discount rate, and then the nearer you get to zero, then there's an exponential effect that occurs that makes liabilities skyrocket. And that's what's happened here with the figure they've used.
Quite so, and I really like your iceberg analogy there, John. So let me consider this further. If I understand this correctly, then the biggest of the other big questions we should have been asking relates to one actual accounting figure. Why has the EU used a nominal discount rate of only 1.9% to come up with this bill?
Thanks, Ali. That's the figure. We've put you in a state of suspension there, and we've come up with this figure. Here it is. 1.9% is the figure that they've used in the accounts. Now, the problem is that when this figure's combined with inflation in the EU, this is the single reason why the bill has skyrocketed in the last 2 years. And similar, I think, completely wrong decisions as to this rate since the crash have caused this liability to almost double. Now, why didn't the EU make a policy decision to freeze or place a ceiling on this discount rate when it was clear each year end that it was causing ridiculous liability increases in the pension fund? Now, another explanation, again, not an excuse, I think, is that nobody really ever bothers about this rather obscure, arcane entry in these annual notional figures.
It's possible then that just as we now have Brexit unfolding, should it proceed as intended, of course, all of a sudden this figure, it's real. I mean, Brexit has given it life and legs.
That's right.
It's been cathartic in that sense to bring it to the fore. Mm-hmm. Because the EU wants the UK to obviously pay them a share of the liabilities, the UK shuts the door and leaves, so to speak. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, yes. But a further explanation is that two parts of the European setup weren't talking to each other, which could have meant the figures would have been put right years ago.
So by that you mean the Commission and the Central Bank?
I think that's correct. Those are the two wings, if you like, of this, that really there was no communication or nobody made the link on either side about the problem with the discount rate figure. Now, when Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank got his bazooka out, as it was called at the time, which was they were going to do whatever it takes and go into the market and purchase bonds, corporate bonds and state bonds, sovereign bonds, really, his officials at the ECB really should have warned the EU Commission that this would mean that their annual accounting figures would go haywire. So Draghi's whatever it takes, humongous state and corporate bond buying QE programme had an immediate and fundamental impact on markets across Europe for bonds.
Can you elaborate?
Well, in the old days, if you like, before 2015, which is when that really big bond buying QE started, obviously it started back in the UK in 2009. I mean, there was, you know, and obviously in the States as well. But the sudden intervention in the market in 25, before then, bond markets had sort of settled post-crash, but obviously wider interventions in bond markets in the UK and the US had started to depress yields on sovereign and corporate bonds generally. But that ECB QE completely changed the game, and there suddenly wasn't actually a real market. It was being gobbled up by intervention from a central bank. So actually using that market to come up with the discount rate figure, which is now at 1.9%, well, using it to set that discount rate in the EU accounts was madness. And the central bank's intervention was so hugely impactful that there was no real market in corporate and sovereign bonds. And the fully functioning bond market ceased as soon as central interest rates collapsed after the crash due to central, not market interventions, and when deflation threatened and recession came, the ECB's utterly unprecedented intervention effectively dismissed the market in bonds in Europe in its entirety.
But if I could put it in such terms, though, another wing of Europe, as you say, the EU simply continued as if nothing had happened.
That's right.
So it is possible to argue that a pretender, the figures coming out of, dysfunctional, effectively non-existent bond market were real? Or, if I understand you correctly, that worse, the EU came up with a discount rate every year that was just wrong. And those pension fund liabilities soared each year.
Indeed. And in addition, here's another very important aspect to what happened. The very intention of the ECB was clearly, and this was very clearly expressed in its policy statements at the time, this wasn't the case in the United States and it wasn't the case in the UK. People, when quantitative easing started, were saying this is inflationary. You're printing money and it will be inflationary. And very clearly, both the central banks in the UK and America and the Treasury made it clear that this was not the case, that this was a policy direction which meant that we could actually bring back liquidity into the market and so on and so forth. They were very cautious about it. But the ECB actually expressed its policy of intervention in 2015 as to actually increase inflation, quote, to around about the 2%, what they regarded as a healthy level. And in fact, that worked. Mm. And earlier this year, EU inflation went to 2%.
I suppose that's the flip side of stoking aggregate demand. I mean, when you refer to restoring liquidity to the markets, I mean, that's really what they mean. Of course, to use terms like stoking inflation is a bit unfortunate because of the negative connotations that has.
I think that the American and British policymakers and the officials in the bank were very, very nervous about the terminology that was being used. Yes, this was going to increase inflation. And of course, it's happened in the UK as well. But this, of course, basically, the ECB said that when we started to get back to 2%, that was seen as a healthy level. And after that, QE would start to stop. And that's an important thing. Coming off a cliff edge is not good when it comes to QE. It would start to stop. And they have now indicated that this will stop at the end of this year. So the problem was you got a double whammy of ultra-low discount rates and then increasing inflation at the same time. Now that just creates a real problem, because once you just start the pension fund liability question with a discount rate at 1.9%, you then have to deduct inflation for what we call the real discount rate. And that's what they apply. That's the ice cube rate that they apply to the iceberg. And that has ended up, therefore, at 1.9 minus the inflation rate last year, 1.4, and it's around about 4%, 0.4% of a discount rate. And that has suddenly happened because of the increase in inflation, and that's what explains the last 2 years in particular. So you end up with this Alice in Wonderland setup when liabilities are set at effectively negative discount rates, because this could happen this year, because obviously, like I've said, another calculation has to be done at the end of this year. We know inflation's at 2%. I've not seen any indication that the bond markets have picked up, so we would end up at this year with a negative discount rate, and it's very difficult to predict what will actually happen to the liabilities then. But it's perfectly possible that the Brexit bill won't just soar, it'll go into orbit.
So, John, what do you suggest we should do about this?
Well, first of all we've got is a set of accounts with some figures in it that has a discount rate in it and a rate of inflation. We have to see all of the actual calculations. Show us your methodology, okay? And let's also ask the Treasury and our negotiators to do alternative calculations based on alternative discount rates. Now, it's happened elsewhere that you could set bond a discount rate based on a longer time scale for the bond rates, perhaps over 25 years, not what they were now. Okay, now this has happened in the United States, and it would probably mean that we could apply discount rates nearer to the norm instead of applying discount rates which are next to zero. And I think it's perfectly possible that we could end up with gilts returning to a normal level over the next few years. But actually, it could be that in our accounts we should be looking at normal rates of 5-7%, and then the EU pension fund would actually see its pretend liabilities effectively evaporate. Now, that's a notional thing. There could actually be a notional surplus, and that would show, actually, in some ways, how ridiculous the calculations have been over the last few years.
Of course, I suppose there is a caveat there in that, in a sense, that one might argue that the discount rates are reflective at the moment of a short-term aberration with very low base rates set by central banks. Could we, are we necessarily assuming here then that in the long run, 20, 30 years, you know, of future rates going forward, that would continue to be the case?
Well, it depends how long is the long run. I mean, I think...
well, if you're Keynes, the long run, we're all dead.
Indeed, very good point. I think Mark Carney said that, you know, since the establishment of the Bank of England way back when, in the 700 years ago now, the historic interest rate has been 5%. That's the long run. And actually, I probably expect us to return to that level. And consequently, and it obviously doesn't just apply to non-funded pension funds like this, but pension funds, in fact, real pension funds, those with an actual fund, will, I think, start to see massive surpluses if they've been applying, as they have been, these low discount rates. There is a wider issue here. But, you know, I have to say why we should be paying these kind of monies to the EU. It may be that we don't owe them a cent, actually, as we exit. And to be frank, the money that we've got in the books at the moment to apparently pay this liability could be, I don't know, spent on the NHS instead, perhaps, to coin a phrase. I'm not being anti-EU here. The methodologies they use aren't atypical of those who calculate pension liabilities within the UK, for example, local authorities or in higher education. But we need to get grips with this artificial problem. We need to see a range of calculations so we can make the right judgment, because we do have to make a judgment as to which route we're going on these liabilities, and we need to do it soon, and that's in the next few weeks.
John, that is I don't want to underestimate the significance of this, because I think what you've just hit on here is Brexit is the catharsis, but the issue stands whether we leave the EU or stay. It really does. And equally so, it could apply to every other member state in the EU, because they're all making contributions on the same premise.
I think that's right. I think that everyone, each of the member states needs to be asking these questions. Do we have a notional accounting exercise that just takes place every year, or are we actually building up liabilities to our individual sovereign state bank balance sheets, because effectively we are here, and if we are going to do that, then it's got to be right.
Indeed. And I suppose with just some moderate element of irony, then, if the Leave campaign slogan about £350 million a week extra for the NHS turned out to have some grain of truth to it, but not for reasons that I possibly would think that they would have construed, lest we be seen as endorsing a particular position.
Well, indeed, there is some angle here that said, obviously, also when the Prime Minister mentioned the extra money for the NHS, she may have inadvertently been correct. but bearing in mind that one of the things we have learned over the last few days in relation to David Davis leaving is that actually one of the points he has made is that the negotiations have been very much led, and the withdrawal agreement has been very much led by number 10. So number 10, actually, it may be in number 10's interests now, actually, to ask the questions I am now asking of the pension fund and its the pension scheme, and that's the point, the pension scheme and its liabilities.
John, you remind me of a great phrase that I always love to recount time and time again, because I'm never any good at it myself. But whilst everyone focuses on the big picture, I think the great art is the art of the small.
Very good.
Very challenging issues you raised today, John, and nonetheless, I think, to reiterate, could be hugely significant in terms of negotiations with the EU, and indeed how other member states adopt an approach to financial contributions to the EU budget. I look forward to chatting about this with you further again soon.
That's right. I do have some further comments I will need to make, perhaps in another blog and podcast, about the exact details of what it says about the pension fund in the withdrawal agreement. And I do have some criticisms to make about that withdrawal agreement.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex and John. Well, that marks the end of today's podcast. I was going to say, I hope you found it interesting and enlightening, but I think it's a bit more than that, to be honest. For more information about the centre and to hear further podcasts, please visit our website at www.bcu.ac.uk/centre-4-Brexit-studies, or find us on Twitter at BCU_CBS. Bye for now.